we're having lunch right now. In any case, I wanted to ask Margot about her remembrances of Thanksgiving, and I don't think she has a lot of them either, and just remarked to me, maybe they didn't make a big deal of Thanksgiving when we were kids. I don't remember, really. I just, as I said on the other tape, it's kind of the, but anyway, Margot, say something.
No, I don't remember many Thanksgivings either until I was certainly a teenager, and the one that comes to mind is my Aunt Bertie and Uncle Fade came for Thanksgiving dinner at our house. And it was my brother, my two brothers and my sister, myself, my mother, and Aunt Bertie and Uncle Fade. And it was a fun time, and there was lots of good food, and everybody enjoyed themselves, but that's the only Thanksgiving I really, really can remember.
What year was that, would you guess?
I have no idea.
Had to
1946.
Wow. In a sense, I'm not sure we have made a big deal out of Thanksgiving, but Thanksgiving somehow wound up to be, with us, the one excuse in the year for everyone to get together, and because we're sort of halfway between Spokane, where Cindy lives, and Seattle, where Kathy lives, that it's just been a convenient place for everyone to meet here. And so it's just, and it has sort of, I don't know, it is a big deal, but it hasn't because it's Thanksgiving, it's because it's been the one annual time when we get together, and pretty much often that's the only time we all do get together with absolute certainty. I met Margot's aunt and uncle in Bay City years ago. I have a vague memory about them. They looked like Iowa farmers or something like that. Old, kind of overweight, and jolly and all that. But in any case, he was a smoker. Margot's not sure. She thinks maybe he smoked cigarettes. But a common practice years ago, less so now, is men carried stick matches in their pocket and they lighted this, whatever they were smoking, pipes or cigars, using a stick match. Well, another common practice among men, and I think it was sort of almost a macho thing, is that they didn't strike the match against the wall or something like that, or a sidewalk. They lighted the match with the tip of their fingernail, their thumbnail, typically, and you can do that, but you have to be fast. You can actually burn your finger, get a little bit of sulfur under your nail or whatever, so it has some aspect of that macho thing about it. But in any case, not a funny story, but an odd story is Uncle Fade, who was one of these thumb strikers, developed a cancer on his thumb, and one surely can say it was from thousands and thousands of match strikes. Now the other thing is, Margot wants to tell a little story. I think we should have on tape and. About her aunt, and it's interesting, although incomplete.
Aunt Bertie was my mother's sister, and their parents came from Germany. And for all the while my grandmother was alive, she corresponded with the relatives in Germany. And when she died, my Aunt Bertie took that correspondence up. And she wrote to the relatives in Germany, whoever they were, for years. When World War II came along, the letters started coming back. And they wouldn't be delivered. And what the reason was, we really didn't know. We just assumed the war had interrupted the delivery system. But after the war, she tried again to contact the relatives in Germany, and the letters did come back at that time saying, addressee unknown. And we never did find out what happened. We don't know whether they were killed or they moved or what, but we never, she was never able to make contact with them again.
Did she write to them in German?
She wrote in German, yes. All of the children in my mother's family were taught to read and write German and speak it.
One of the things that perhaps is difficult for everyone, even me, I guess, how many people died in Germany and sometimes died overnight in single bombing raids. You know, we bombed some of those cities with 2,000 bomber raids, and Dresden's very famous, and I think in Dresden, Germany, 100,000 died with the firestorms. But I think there was one night in Hamburg, we killed 40,000. Think of that, 40,000 people in one night. And what's a strange juxtaposition against this is, you know, right now the second trial is going on for the bombing in the federal building in Oklahoma that's been absolutely on the news every day for, 2 years. And it was such a tragedy, and the president was involved, and, you know, monuments and all that business. And we only lost 267 or some number, I think, on the 300 in any case. Think about living in a town, not where you lose 268 or whatever, but you lose 40,000 in a single night. I don't know, as a PS to what I just said, I don't know if it's ever been completely reported or officially reported what the bomb was in the Oklahoma City bombing, but I think maybe they think about 4,000 pounds of explosive materials. If you think in World War II, we dropped 2,000 pound bombs, a whole plane load of them, and not a plane load, but plane loads of 2,000 pound bombs. So what happened in Oklahoma City, don't forget, happened in street after street after street after neighborhood after mile in all kinds of cities like Tokyo and Yokohama and Hamburg and whatever. Endless bombings. To change the subject to a more cheerful report, broken bones. Margo has never really officially had a broken bone, ever. Now, I broke my ankle here in Ellensburg one morning. We were out jogging and I fell in a hole. I broke my knee playing, we're talking about fractured bones now, broken bones. I broke my knee or the leg bone near my knee playing basketball when I was about 16. I broke my shoulder slipping down some concrete steps wearing shoes that had leather soles, not rubber soles, but leather soles, and they just slipped out from underneath my feet. What else? I fractured my skull when I was a kid running through the house at breakneck speed playing and slipped somewhere along the line. And I think I fell into the corner of a cedar chest and busted my head. I've, of course, never been the same. I also think, what else? I think maybe I broke, I always thought I broke a finger once, and I never had it treated, and I was doing handstands, and I wound up standing on my, not on my hand, but one finger, and I think I snapped it, but I never did anything about it. Just, it eventually got better. In our endless pursuit of truth and accuracy, when I broke my shoulder, I didn't just have soles made of leather, but my heels, the heels of the shoes were made of leather. And that's what made me slip. Leather heels, I don't know that you see them much anymore. And they typically, when you had leather heels, you wore a metal tap on them, a little kind of an iron plate. And that's what really made me slip, was not the soles, but the heels. At one time, doctors made house calls. I wonder if that word is not slowly becoming obsolete like the word gas wars. But in any case, doctors made house calls. I remember seeing doctors visiting my home when I was a little kid and seeing me in my bedroom or whatever. Anyway, not only did the doctors make house calls, but they actually came to your home sometimes and operated. Now get this now. Margot had her tonsils removed on the kitchen table in her home. Her sister Phyllis had her tonsils removed on the kitchen table in her home. And her sister also had her ears lanced, whatever that means, some kind of infection or something. Actually an operation at home on the kitchen table. And of course I think women had often, now I don't know often, I don't know what frequency, but had children at home. They didn't have necessarily always go to hospitals. So there was a lot of home medication, if you think about it, and something that's about now, I think the only thing you get to do at home is die. As a matter of fact, and as a kind of P.S., Margot's mother had 5 children at home, born at home. She did not go to the hospital to have these children. She had them delivered at home. Subject is shoemakers. I think shoemakers, when we were growing up, were a lot more important than they are now. I can only think of one shoemaker in all of Yakima. I'm sure there are more, but I only know of one shoemaker. And there's a shoemaker here in Ellensburg where you get heels and soles or whatever on your shoes or boots or whatever. But I don't know that I've taken a pair of shoes to a shoemaker in, I don't know, a quarter of a century, I don't think. And only occasionally do we take a pair of Margot's shoes to have a heel put on, but mostly not. And I just to sort of satisfy myself, I went back and looked in my closet. And the shoes I have some nice shoes, costing $100 a pair when new. But they're a single rubber sole, heel and sole all joined in one. Mm-hmm. When you wear them down, and they're pretty tough, but when you wear them down, you simply throw them away and go buy a new pair. Where when we were children, people had their shoes repaired over and over and over again. And in fact, shoemakers often had one or two little booths, if you will, and that was a chair and a kind of wooden balustrade around it, and you could go in and it was shoe repair while you wait. And you take your shoes off and then put a new sole or whatever on and you'd pay for them and walk out. That was, of course, I suppose, started because a lot of people didn't own 2 pair of shoes. They owned a pair and that was the pair they were walking around in. And my everyday shoes that I wear when I'm, you know, when I'm really not working around town or around, I wear tennis shoes, cloth, regular shoes that are suitable for playing tennis. And I think pretty much you never repair those, you wear them out. And I keep sort of 3 pair in circulation all the time. I have kind of a newer pair and a medium pair and then a really grungy pair. And I've done that for years, using tennis shoes, and I'm satisfied. My feet are okay and they work, but again, the shoemaker's not getting any business from me. Finally, on shoes, I clearly remember wearing big holes in my shoes. I'm talking about holes certainly is at least as big as a quarter, maybe a half dollar. I typically cut out a piece of cardboard and put them in my shoe when I wore cardboard to cover the hole. I, in fact, thought I was a sort of a cardboard connoisseur. I knew which kind of cardboard would give me the best wear. I don't know. I'm not sure. I can't remember going to my parents and saying, you know, my shoes have holes in them. but I don't remember my parents saying, gee, why are you cutting that cardboard out? What is that? But I remember doing it clearly when I was at home and my father was alive. And you know, I think it's strange. And I suppose it's what the bottom line always is, a matter of money. Finally, I have to just say this. I know many of the listeners to this tape are going to think I'm incredibly prideful and all that, but I consider that I have absolutely probably one of the most beautiful pair of feet in Christendom. I think my feet are absolutely gorgeous. People with foot fetishes would walk for miles of just to even just sort of glance at them. Now, why this is, I don't know. Why I'm blessed with beautiful feet, or why, I just simply don't know. But my feet are absolutely, oh. Union City, New Jersey, which I think is, I don't know what exactly, a suburb of Jersey City perhaps, or a nearby city or whatever. I don't think it's far away. I haven't bothered to look at the map, but Union City is a place near Jersey City. It is now, I forget, I think it's the sort of headquarters for the entire Haitian mob, all the Haitian drug dealers are there. But in any case, I have to tell you this wonderful little short story. Union City had a burlesque show. Now, a burlesque show was a wonderful thing. I guess they're not around anymore. They were a theater, folk theater, if you will. They had kind of standard things. They had a magician. They had a couple of comedians. They had some pratfall guys. They might have jugglers. A lot of it was sort of the humor was a little bit off color and risque. Always had girlies, you know, some kind of girl show. A striptease act maybe was a common thing in burlesque. Well, I went to a burlesque show. I only went once. I don't remember the circumstances, but I went as a kid. I was a kid when I went to this, and I went with at least a couple of other guys. We had to be really young. I don't think you could even go to a burlesque show as a kid, but I think it was, again, the bottom line, and it was, I don't know why, Wednesday afternoon, and they let us in, or I don't think it cost much money. I loved the burlesque. It just left an incredible, indelible memory in my mind of what a wonderful kind of folk theater, if you will, this was, with comedy and pratfalls and humor and guys on stilts and kind of off-color jokes, I suppose, which I didn't get. It was just, you know, it was a who's on first and what's on second and that kind of thing. Only went once. I thought it was remarkable. I would sort of PS this comment to say, you know, the burlesque theater has, I'm sure the history goes right back through Italian comedy and medieval passion plays or morality plays, back right to the Greeks. I think if you read Hamlet, you can see where there's a play within the play, you know, there's players there and so forth. And Margot's read stories about medieval plays. And what's wonderful is they even have a language of gestures. And I said to Margot one day, let me make a guess. I want to make a guess. Tell me some of the things. Well, she said, well, the Italian gentleman who's a sneaky guy, well, how do you know who he is? And I could guess. I guessed the gesture of that. And I think the history of this is wonderful. And I'm just, I suppose, dangerously undereducated in this whole matter. In re-listening to this prior portion of the tape, I suspect I've confused a little bit the idea of a theater where you there's a storyline, like medieval morality plays had storylines, and really vaudeville and burlesque didn't have storylines. They might have a skit or something, but not storylines. There's so much. I don't think that's a big terrible error I made. But in any case, what about vaudeville? Well, I think vaudeville, I guess I would say that burlesque was the kind of vaudeville, and vaudeville was popular entertainment, just like burlesque was, except the kinds of the audience and the kind of thing. I think burlesque had more risque stuff and girly shows and take it off and all that kind of thing. And vaudeville maybe was more for the family. Well up into the, I don't know how late, but well up into the 40s, I guess, movie houses in New York City often would play a movie, and then they would have some kind of vaudeville something. Maybe they have a comedian and a singer or something like that. So this sort of entertainment is really, really old and still around. Cindy and Pease. Now, when Cindy was a little baby, when we lived in Germany, she didn't like peas. She hated peas, you know, that you could buy little jars of baby food, pureed baby food, what have you, and they carrots and string beans, who knows what, but she wouldn't eat peas at all. And in fact, if you fed her peas, she would spit them out at you. She would just, you'd get them in her mouth and they would be right back in your face. She was, and she was bad about that. She just all over everything. And she was a pig of an eater anyway. Her sister was this neatnik who liked to, she would eat with a washcloth in one hand to make sure her little tray was clean. Cindy was like Miss Slop. So anyway, I decided to do this scientific test one day. I knew that this was just, we could overcome this through diligence. So I was feeding Cindy lunch one day, who knows what, but some kind of mashed potatoes and carrots and that sort of thing. New England boiled dinner without the meat. And I carefully mashed up a pea and buried it into something like mashed potatoes. And I was feeding on. I fed her that pea and she knew immediately. She had some kind of pea sensor and she just spit that thing all over me that I would dare serve her a pea. I don't know whether she eats them now or not. I would guess she did, but when she was little, she thought they were deadly poison. Uncle Ed and Garlic. Quick story. Margot went home and to Bay City, Monroe Street, and she did some cooking while she was there. Both of her brothers lived at home. Edward worked, and Jim did, I guess, too. But anyway, she cooked something. I don't know what she cooked, but whatever it was, she used some garlic in it. And Brother Edward, Uncle Ed, tasted this garlic, and he thought he was poisoned, like Cindy with the pea. And he simply had a cow about it. And he, like, wouldn't eat anymore. He knew that Margot was putting garlic in everything, and that it was deadly poison. And I always thought that was a funny story. It's, of course, Christmas time here, 1997, and Margot's going to tell two and maybe three Christmas stories that might be, should be on tape. So here's Margot.
Well, the first Christmas story is about my Aunt Bertie, who used to always, every Christmas, write us letters from Santa Claus. And tell us some of the things that we had done during the year that were bad or some of the things that were good. And one summer, we played baseball in the backyard, and I hit the ball, and the ball went through a basement window and broke it. And I was heartbroken about this, that I broke a window in the basement. And I went running and crying and told my parents, and nothing ever came of it as far as I remember. I wasn't punished or anything like that at all, but she somehow latched onto the story, and she knew that I had been very upset about that window. So when Christmas time came that year, I got a letter from Santa Claus telling me that he didn't know whether I was going to get anything for Christmas that year because I had broken that basement window. Well, I want to tell you, up until Christmas when we opened our presents, I did not think Santa Claus was going to visit me that year. The second story I have to tell is really a fun story, and it's about my dad. My father loved Christmas. It was his time of year. And he was as excited about opening presents and the tree and all those things as any of the children were. And this one year, I don't know how old I was, but again, I must have been under 7. We were all sound asleep in our beds, or at least I was sound asleep in my bed. And the next thing I know, my dad was yelling at us, "Get up, get up! Santa Claus is here! Santa Claus is here! Come see Santa Claus!" And I remember jumping out of the bed and running into this big room that we had on the second floor of our house, and that served as a living room when the downstairs was being used as a funeral parlor. And he said, "Hurry, hurry, if you come to the window, you can see him. He's just flying off over there." And we all ran to the window, and we stood there looking and looking.
Two ladies just went over the chimney.
And of course we couldn't see Santa Claus, and we were so disappointed. So my dad looked at all our faces and he said, "Well, my goodness, if he was flying off over there, he must have already been to our house. So let's go downstairs and see if he left anything for us." And this was about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and my mother was not happy about any of this. But downstairs we all trooped at this hour of the morning, and sure enough, my father lighted the tree, and there were presents galore. And we had our Christmas at that time that morning.
That's a fun story. We have a couple more Christmas stories to tell. I suppose many if we sat, hopefully we could sit around and think of these. But I'll tell you what I suppose is a poignant Christmas story. When I was a kid, and I've been sitting here trying to think how old I was. I want to say 9, but I'm not sure. But in any case, I was a little kid. And I received at Christmas time a harmonica. It was a beautiful made in Germany, big harmonica. It was like 6 inches or something like that. It was a really like professional looking harmonica. I wondered after that where my parents got it from, and you know, my mother's mother ran what everyone in those days called a candy store, and she sold toys and things like that in her store. Had some really collector's items now that I think back on them, but I don't know that she ever sold many, but she had them for sale. And I wondered if they got this harmonica from her. But in any case, I was quite taken with it. I couldn't play it, but I remember going out on the front stoop, which is a really Eastern word, isn't it? Going back to the Dutch, S-T-O-E-P, I think. But anyway, I went out on the stoop and was blowing on my harmonica. And a kid I knew, you know, a peer, if you will, came up to me and said, "What do you got?" I said, "Oh, I got this harmonica." He said, "Whoa, where'd you get the harmonica?" I said, "I got it for Christmas. This is a Christmas present." He said something like, "Oh, you didn't get that for Christmas. It's rusty." And he pointed to the chrome part of the, you know, the side of the harmonica and said, "See, look, it's all rusty, so you didn't get that for Christmas, did you?" And I simply lied and said, "No, I didn't. I have had it a long time." To interrupt our Christmas stories and as an afterthought on people being operated on in kitchen tables at home, there's a report out today in, on the National Public Radio, and what it said was this. 50 years ago, so let's say right up through World War II, 50% of visits to doctors took place in people's homes. Think of that, 50%. Now the number is minuscule and is mostly, they said, related to very sick, sick old people that can't get to the doctor. And they said the typical doctor's visit now is to an 85-year-old bedridden single woman or widow woman. So just think about in 50 years where you went from 50% home visits to practically none now. And if you think about whoever is listening to this, I can't remember. I'd ask Marco now, when was the last time a doctor ever visited anybody that we, our house or our home? I don't remember. Although you can make a good case, it was a great idea. I mean, he had an opportunity to see what was going on and could look around and see whether the place was clean or whether there was food in the refrigerator or, you know, those kind of things. He could make a better evaluation than asking questions like, "Do you have food at home?" And maybe the patient would say, "Of course I have food at home." But he had the chance to go in and kind of snoop around and see if he did have food at home. So it's too bad.